Blog Talk Radio.
Home of the stars, through the airwaves and on the big screen. Coming to you live from Hollywood, it's Rated G Radio with your host, Garrett Miller.
Hey everybody, welcome to Rated G Radio. We are going to be live for the next hour tonight, and in just a couple of moments, we're going to be bringing on author Jim Keck on the show. He is the author of The Big House, Story of a Southern Family, and it's a book that I started reading over the weekend, and it's, well, I'm going to gush when I get Jim on the phone in just a second, and not really embarrass him, hopefully, but just tell him what a great writer he is, but I haven't been able to put the book down, and so I put it down about half an hour before the show started tonight, so we could do the show. But I hope you will actually, of course, always support the cause and go out and purchase the wares of our guests. I've put a convenient little link to The Big House on Amazon that's on the show page, as well as the Facebook fan page for The Big House. If you would like to go and find out more and check it out, I always encourage you to do that. Big shout out today to Mr. R.J. Tolson, who I got to see right before my vocal lesson today, and we were talking about some business planning stuff that we're working on for the new album, including a new repackaging or re-release date for the first album I did a couple of years ago called Eyes Wide. That'll be coming out in April, so I'll be telling you more about that as the days get closer. But now we are going to welcome our VIP special guest star tonight, and that is Mr. Jim Keck. Jim, thank you for being here on the show.
Well, I really feel welcome. Thank you so much.
Thank you. So for like I do when I have all of my guests on for the first time, I always say if you can, you know, tell us a little bit about yourself and your background so the listeners can get a feel for who you are as a writer, that would be really cool. And then I want to talk about The Big House.
All righty. I think on my bio and everything, I mentioned that I was born and reared on the West Coast, but also our family had land back in the South. So I, in a sense, went back and forth between here and the South. And I think that really, and my family being Southern, we were Southern inside the house, even though we were West Coast. We walk out the door and we're West Coast people. So that gives you a little bit of a background. But one thing about a Southern family is they love to tell stories, and most Southern families have long histories that they just love to share with the grandchildren, great-grandchildren, and so forth. So I was, at an early age, exposed to all of that.
So where did your ability to tell a good story come from? And have you always been a storyteller?
I was thinking about that before you invited me on the air. And I guess in grammar school, I was told I was a pretty good storyteller, for what that means. And and it just stuck with me. And though I went in very different directions educationally, I always loved to write. And so now I've had the opportunity to come back and do the thing I love most.
So we're going to talk about The Big House in just a second. Have you written other books that people might also like, or what's your writing background, I should say?
I have a novella and a short story out, and there the genre is quite different than this particular book, The Big House, and I'm working on the sequel to it, and the rough draft's been done, and I've been consulting with the editor on the sequel. And I hope to get that out in a couple months. And my real focus, though, is on the series, the Big House series, which should cover maybe book 1 through 5. And so what we're hearing about, I guess, this evening is book 1, the Big House.
And so I need to tell you, Jim, rarely do I pick up a book and get so immediately captivated by the characters and the imagery and everything that's going on than when I first opened up The Big House on Saturday afternoon when the mail came. And one of the things that I think that I found interesting is just how rich the characters are and how deep and dark some of their secrets are and the history behind all of that. And it goes back, I think, to your great storytelling. So can you tell us about the main character in the book and what makes her special for you?
Yes. It's an adolescent girl, and she is going through rites of passage. And this is really the story that reaches all the way back to the Odyssey and Iliad, and way back to the story of the hero slash heroine and their trials and adversities in order, it's a pilgrimage in a sense, to self-awareness and self-identity. So that sort of underlies it. And this particular character is very close to my heart because of the issue of survival and the kind of work that I had done at one point in time in the way of therapy, psychotherapy, that I've seen many different situations, and I think that's one reason when you began to read the book, you sensed the emotional layering of the character, because this young girl to be a woman really carries with her a rich history that has been layered because of all the different people in her life, in the way of family in particular, that have shaped her character. I don't know if I answered your question exactly.
No, that's great. I think when I started to read the book, and as I'm getting into this, you know, every character, here's what I came away, at least as far as I am in the book right now, Jim, is that this would make a great movie or a great miniseries or a great nighttime soap opera or something like that, because it just drips with imagery and the people that you think are really one way maybe reveal a little something else about themselves, and your perception of them change a great deal, from the grandmother or even which is really the great grandmother, to the grandpa or the mother, or just all of the other characters that are popping up in the book. You really think, oh, I've got this person figured out, and then the next thing you know, there's the big reveal, and you're like, I can't believe they shared that or told this or did that. And I think that's one of the things that I'm just enjoying so much about your book. It is so rich in the character development, and it's beautifully written.
Well, I want to thank you for that. And I'm really glad that you're enjoying the story. A friend of mine who is a screenwriter had said to me, you write more like a screenwriter. And I think that is one of the things I'm hearing from you, is that because of the imagery and the emotional drama and layering of the characters, that you very much feel like it is either a television series, part of a television series,
mm-hmm.
or maybe a movie. And that had been mentioned to me by more than a few readers as well.
Well, I'm just in love with the characters here, and just some of the things that you use as far as the phrasing and the conversations that they have, it just flows. It is just beautifully, beautifully written. So I'm shocked, but I'm shocked that you don't have another 50 books that were out there before this came out, because this reads like a book of a much of a seasoned writer of, 50, 60 novels, and then you come up with The Big House as, your big novel. This is just a masterpiece. So,
Garrett, maybe yourself and maybe a lot of other people have this story within them that is begging them out. And, you give it a chance and you're surprised with what emerges, that the characters begin to talk to you.
Yeah,
and you
don't very much.
And everything. It sort of brings me to something I really kind of is near and dear to my heart, which is the introduction to the book. that's, I like to think, really sets the tone for the book itself. And if you don't mind me reading it, I'd like to.
I would love it.
The big house can be less a dwelling and more of a state of mind that transcends structure. Much like one of the bricks used by the mason, the house and its people are shaped by time and circumstance. The woman and man of character were once children within these walls, however briefly. This is the story of one such youth. And I'd like to think that that sets the tone for everything that follows.
Well, it sets it beautifully. So, Jim, as a writer, before you sat down to write this book, how did you decide that, boy, I'm going to write a piece on Southern historical fiction? What kind of draws you to that genre of writing?
Well, if I may, I'm just going to take your question a little more indirectly.
Sure.
And I realized I was writing and have written chapters from book 4 and 5. And they were well received by various listeners. And then I thought, well, you know, I might as well start in the beginning, at the beginning. And then that's when I began to write this book. And it, that, like I said, it just began to flow. It just seemed to take on a life of its own. And sometimes I would wake up in the middle of the night, and all of a sudden there would be a scene there, and there would be character. One character making a point to another character. And usually, I would, like I said, go with the flow, get up, and just write. So part of that, I've been fascinated by different writers' stories about how they get themselves to write. And some say, oh, I sit down and whether I write anything but a sentence for one entire hour, I do it. I have a definite time. Well, it didn't work that way for me, and I sort of attribute it, at least my style, more to the seasons. And that is that I finally got comfortable with the idea that there is such a thing called winter when things are fallow. And you just have to sit with it and let things begin to grow underneath the ground until they're ready to push up and bud. So that became my style, and I became comfortable with it.
What a beautiful way to put that. That's an excellent answer. So for the big house, because obviously you didn't grow up in the 1920s where you were writing about. Where do you start to do research for such a expansive story?
Oh, my. Well, as you know, you may have gotten to the point where because of the matriarch, the great-grandmother, who had been born in the antebellum South into a planter's family who had sent her both to Southern academies and Northern academies, it required of me to do a lot of research in terms of what the educational systems were like before the Civil War, after the Civil War. I used the internet. There were various books where I would get a feeling for something. Of course, there's the internet that was a wonderful source of information. And without a doubt, there's always family for research as well as extended family. And then you get to friends, and then you get the person you meet by accident on the phone because you have an intention to get to one place, and instead you find someone that you're talking to, and then they're starting to tell you a story about their family. And all of a sudden, they've just given you information that you had not even imagined was critical. to what the development of a character and a time period. If I may, for example, I called Memphis and I called the Catholic Archdiocese.
Mm-hmm.
They then sent me to the archives. And out of that, I found out that there were really only two Catholic churches in Memphis at this time in 1925.
Oh, my.
One, St. Peter's, was for the rich Catholics, wealthy Catholics, and St. Mary's for the working class. So you begin to see how the society is stratified. And it's a process of poking around and talking to them, because I like to talk to people directly, that a lot of the research that you're doing, the facts of the time period and what would be the character development, that begins to emerge.
So can you maybe touch just a little bit on, you know, how the maybe like race relations or how just the differences in cultures impacted the story that you chose to tell?
I think there are two questions here. One, race relations, and the other one that really has to do, especially at that time and before, class stratification, because this young person, Minnie, obviously comes from a well-to-do family.
Mm-hmm.
And one way I was able to illustrate that was by way of that the grandpa, and I had no idea that there was such a thing as a Franklin automobile, which appears on the cover of the book. And in researching, I discovered, yes, indeed, I'd been told in the family that there were Franklin automobiles. Well, that's why, at the beginning of the story, I mentioned the fact that the Franklin cost $2,500, when a Ford automobile cost $400, and a loaf of bread cost 3 cents. So that
great
was my way of...
Yeah.
Giving perspective to the reader of how wealthy this family was, when at that time, there were very few people who had wealth in the South, especially given the Civil War, and where ever so many more were rural or they were small towns people. So there was great stratification there.
Mm-hmm.
And the other part of the question, I think, had to do with race relations.
Right.
And the thing you might remember is this family, they had an African-American cook named Annie. And that the character, Minnie, she bonds with Annie because her own mother is very distant and somewhat cold. And Annie becomes her protector. Later in the development of this book, what I wanted to show when someone from the industry up in Hollywood asked me a question about do I address the KKK, I had said in this particular novel, I address the issue of the Jim Crow laws and how painful those laws were. But in this particular novel, I address the issue of race through the eyes of this young white person when those laws directly impact her life and her emotional support system by keeping her away from the very person who loves her the most. The cook.
Mm-hmm. 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 And the same applies when she goes to, you know, summer with her grandfather, and you have Marie as the grandfather's, I'm not even sure, you know, it's very colorful, and it leaves a lot to interpretation, Jim. When in reading The Big House, you have all these little nuances, or, you know, Minnie talks about, well, this is what they say.
Correct.
And you know exactly what Minnie means when you read the phrase or you hear the statement that the person said. And just the tone of the writing just expresses so much in just how the words are put together. And that sounds silly to talk about in a book because that's all they are words. But they're so masterfully partnered with the right words, the right expression, or the right story as you're telling, you know, about what's going on. At least for me, I can't help but think that I'm actually in, I'm in their kitchen. I'm watching this take place, you know, as she's fishing, or I'm seeing the conversation with the grandmother, or any of the different types of things, because you take us right to that location. You are actually part of, you're like the proverbial fly on the wall. And that's how you write. But you pick up so much, the way the person, you know, nodded their head or opened their eyes or winked at you. And it just speaks volumes to the relationships that these people have with each other that just goes so much farther than just, you know, she's the maid, or it's my grandfather, or it's my grandmother. And it's the relationships you build on this that I think are so rich in the writing that you have for The Big House.
Well, I appreciate hearing that, and it makes me think of the fact that perhaps those years of doing therapy, that one aspect, one very important theory was that 70% of communication is nonverbal. It's through the tone of voice, it's by way of body language, and then comes the other 30%, which are the content of our words, are the words themselves. So that's the heavy emphasis on many of these nonverbals and the pictorial aspect of the book. You touched upon some of the nuances, too. Again, this is an unconventional family in the South, the Big House. This is it's not the house that the character grows up in Memphis with her mother and father, but it's her grandfather's retreat, which is in the style of a plantation house, that is her refuge from the problems at home. So these nuances that you mention, one is the woman of color who runs the Big House to the consternation of a small southern town, that this just isn't done. But given the nature of the grandfather, who had killed many a man while he's building this empire, no one's going to cross him. And then you get a little sense, and that's all I wanted to do in the first novel as opposed to the sequel, you get a little bit of a sense that there's more to Marie, the woman of color, who really runs the Big House behind the scenes, than is made apparent. And there is one of the things that the great-grandmother says to the character Minnie is that you don't really know about Marie's background, do you?
No, you don't. And you want to know more.
Yes, and then that's when the grandmother alludes to, she said, well, you know, her people also had servants before the Civil War. And this is the issue comes to the issue of that segment of the Southern African American population that were free people. And as free people, they also lived a lifestyle that was very much akin to the lifestyle of other free people who happened to be white. So they had servants. That was the polite term for they owned slaves. So Marie comes from a background that's very different from many of her compatriots in this small southern town who are African American. But she comes from New Orleans, and New Orleans has a very rich history by itself. So I think these are some of the nuances and some of the subtext that you're picking up on.
Well, I can't wait for the sequel, and I can't wait to finish this The Big House in the next couple of days. So, again, everybody who's tuning in tonight, we've got Jim Keck. He's the author of The Big House, Story of a Southern Family. He's the author of this brilliant, brilliant novel, and I'm so lucky that he is joining us here on Rated G Radio tonight. If you are looking at the show live or in Technicolor, down at the bottom of the page, there's a couple of links I want you to take advantage of. There's a link to go like Jim's Facebook page for The Big House. Go click that and like it. You can get some updates there. But more importantly, go support the cause and buy his book tonight. You can buy it on Amazon, on Kindle. I think it was a bargain earlier when I was looking at the price when I was updating the show link to have that included. So go download that and read it tonight. Jim, I want to talk to you just a little bit about your process as an author and going some, you know, just talking more about that. But I want to tell everybody, I was just really so excited to get the book in the mail on Saturday because I had the PDF that his publicist sent over to me. So thank you, Francesca, for getting that over. You did a fantastic job. But there's nothing I like better than putting a book in my hand and being able to turn that page and go back and reread things that's not electronic. But tonight, go buy the electronic version. It's a deal. Go do that. But I love having this book in here. And it's from a reading standpoint, I think it's the right – it sounds silly to say, but the type size is the right type, the right number of words to the page, and it's the right book to, you know, carry around with you. So if you want to go get the hardback, I suggest that you do that too.
You like the cover, Garrett?
I love the cover. You know what? There are two things about the cover. I love the car, and then I love, of course, The Big House, because now when I read the paragraphs in the book and, the, you know, about the stairs and the steps and this and that, that's exactly what I picture. I picture exactly what's on the cover.
You know, I'm really pleased to hear that. And the story of the car itself was a journey in terms of the research that I actually contacted the Franklin Association of America.
Wow.
To get additional information on the car, how it operated, various things like that. And one of the stories that had to do with her great-grandmother, when she goes to visit New York City with her son, and she goes reluctantly and sees Sherman's statue. Again, I had to make sure that of who the mayor was at that time in 1923 and who the senator from South Carolina was by name. Those are just some of the things that has to do with that have to do with proofing to make sure that everything is historically accurate.
Well, I think that's one of the things that I like about your book. Well, I like so many things. But one of the things that I like about reading your book, you are historically accurate on all of your details. So the details, I think, just help give validation to your story. Because actually, when I first started reading this, I was thinking, you know, until I, you know, got in this, I was like, I bet this is, you know, a story of Jim's life. And then, no, it's a novel, and the main character is Minnie, and we're going to learn about this. But you have all of the other things, you know, checkmarked along the way. So as you're telling the story or you're going back and recounting something that maybe the grandmother had shared about her youth and growing up during the war, you hear different things that come up, but it's all, you know, it's like, oh, okay, it's like reading just a historical account, not necessarily a work of fiction, which this is. So this is, I think, just adds that much more depth to your work as a writer. So, Jim, let me ask you this. When did you sit down to write The Big House? How long ago did you jump back and say, this is something I'm going to do?
Well, as I mentioned, Garrett, that's a good question, because as I mentioned to you, about 7 years ago, I began writing some of the stories that were really pertained to book 3 and 4. And The Big House itself, now the book 1, was started about 3 years ago, 3 to 4 years ago.
Wow.
And I was thinking also about, you know, this thing of research, that something as simple as a fan, that you read about in one of the stories where the grandpa goes out and mm-hmm. he makes sure there are fans in all the rooms for everyone. Well, I had to go and find out, did the fan exist in 1925? When was the fan discovered? And various other details that we just take for granted today, that the research for things that seem inconsequential was fascinating in and of itself. And I think, you know, Garrett, one of the things that struck me so deeply, and I hope really came through with the character, was a major rite of passage when she cut her hair. And I was able to get a full sense of what that meant in 1926 when a woman cut her hair, that there are photos on the internet when one does the research that of barbershops, since there were only 5% of the places to have your hair cut were salons for women, 95% were barbershops.
Wow.
So all the young women and women had to go to barbershops to have their hair cut. And you see piles of hair by each barber chair. And the fact that it was during this period in the 20s that the real revolution for women occurred, in that their hemline finally, after thousands of years, went up to their knees. They no longer wore long dresses. Their hair was cut, and they will begin to, makeup goes back much farther, and they got the vote. But this was a fundamental revolutionary period for today's modern woman. And that's why I really wanted to make a point in the book that when this young girl, or I should say adolescent, had her hair cut, that she was making a statement about herself, that she now had entered into the modern age, a new world that was unlike any before her, and that was now part of her identity, and allowed for a level of self-assertion that otherwise might not have been there. I found the researching in doing all of that just fascinating.
So did you do this as a full-time effort, or is this something you just kind of did on the weekends or when it was a blue moon? Or, you know, what's your process for this, Jim?
I'll tease you. Only on a full moon.
Fair enough.
Fortunately, I was in a position that I could devote my full time to it.
Wow. So from the time that you put your first words on paper for this book, realizing that you'd already come up with some ideas for, you know, volumes 3 and 4, which we'll see, you know, sometime down the road, how long did it take you to complete the first draft or first run through of The Big House?
I think from the time I started writing until I was finished with the editing, then having editors look at it, and then the proofreading, and then the cover, all the things that went into it, I think you're looking at about 3 years, maybe
wow.
4 on the side.
Wow.
But, looking back, at the time, I would have to say that was a rite of passage for myself. Because I was in need of transformation. I was at a particular place in my life that it was time for a change of identity.
Okay.
And fortunately, all of this, these stories and everything, were just in the back of my mind, and I guess I gave in to them and said, all right, you're going to have your day. I'll tell your story.
So, Jim, when you are doing this, how difficult is it? Because if you've already got, you know, books 3 and 4 planned out, how difficult is it to go back to what was, you know, probably at some point books 3 and 4 were book 1 and 2? How difficult is it to go back and say, well, now we're really going to go back in time and create book 1, and then make sure that, you know, you stay on track to get eventually to your book 3s, 4, and 5?
Well, I can only hope that I will get to book 3, 4, and 5. Staying on track has been relatively easy, except, as I mentioned, the characters take on a life of their own. And along the way, you realize, or at least I realized, that even though I may have thought that I had finished the novel, there were more stories to be told. There were more aspects of a character or a situation. So I chose to go, like I said, with the flow,
mm-hmm.
and allow the book to organically grow. So sometimes, at least in the second novel, the sequel, I've had to go back to tell more, maybe a new story that I hadn't even thought of that presents itself by way of the characters. So I have to describe it as an organic process. It grows, and it just has a life of its own.
Well, in that organic process, then, what happens when your growth is stunted and you come across a terrible case of writer's block, or do you even suffer from that?
Well, you know, I think that is a really good question. I think many people who have either written for pleasure or write as a profession or write as a student, they run up against writer's block. And as I mentioned before, I got comfortable with my writer's block. I came to peace, made peace with it,
mm-hmm.
by accepting it. And instead of, like I said, some individuals who will say, I force myself to sit there day in and day out for an hour or two, whether something comes or not. Now, that's just not my nature. So I realized that when there were 3 weeks, 4 weeks, 5 weeks that passed, that I just wasn't in the mood or something, I just wasn't ready to do it, that everything was germinating. Like I said, it was like winter
mm-hmm.
time.
Yeah, yeah.
And I just had to be patient. I learned to be patient with the process, my own process. And, like I said, wait for the voices, for the characters to start to talk and dialogue. And I said, you're back, finally.
And then when you would get to that point, you know, was it like you've just turned 13 and you hit your growth spurt and you just sit down and you're writing nonstop for, you know, a week or something like that? Or, you know, I would think that, you know, when that conversation starts in your head, they're probably very loud.
They're very loud. And sometimes it's happened where I walk out of the house and the first person I see, I address as one by name of one of the characters. And I realize, and I say to myself, come back, little Sheba, come back, come back, come back. You know, come back to reality.
Right.
This is no longer the big house.
There you go.
So, at least for myself, I become very immersed in the situation, in the characters, in the dialogue. And you, just as an aside, one thing I found fascinating that had to do with dialect, and that in doing the research, looking at the upper class Southern dialect, especially at that particular time, as opposed to country dialect, and one of which in the Arkansas Delta was called lazy jaw, where the mouth really, the lips don't move, and allowing the character and doing the research to make sure that the idioms and that the words themselves were spelled in such a way that the reader got a sense of just how different this character was from another character. And dialect, I think, is very important in being able to almost pictorially draw that distinction, if that makes sense to you, Gary.
Well, it does. And, you know, one of the examples that you have in the book is when Marie is talking to the grandmother, she'll speak a certain way and maybe let her guard down a little bit versus when she's talking to other people that you might meet out socially. And it's very, well, I just find it very interesting because Minnie makes a point several times of saying, well, you know, this and that and the other thing. But she's talking about, you know, the change in, you know, the change in posture, the change in the smile, the change in the dialect. And it's all dependent upon, you know, the set of circumstances that the characters are put in on what airs they're putting out. And I really enjoy that process in reading this book, The Big House. So I can't wait for more.
Well, you know, with the dialect, and with the interaction, I made a point by way of the central character's observation of what was happening for the reader to see that there was a change. There was a class difference in the way people spoke, as well as when dialect was used and why dialect might be used by an upper-class person, because they were letting their hair down, so to speak.
Right.
And when the Union soldiers, the grandmother was reenacting the Civil War when she stood on the porch,
mm-hmm.
holding her gun, defending her home and her children, I really had to do a lot of research about what the accent would be for a soldier who came, let's say, from Vermont or New England, and how that would read and sound as opposed to the way the grandmother, as a Southerner, was communicating to them. So I hope that by way of dialect and also by way of accent, that it delineated or defined these characters a little more clearly in the readers, for the reader, so you've got a better sense of.
I think you get a great sense of who these characters are exactly by that definition. So let me ask you this, Jim. You know, this is the first in a series of five. What did you set out to do a series? Did you think that this would be, you know, like your Empire Strikes Back with 50, you know, chapters along the way, or what was you know? How did that happen? Because honestly, as an author, I think you're one of the first authors that I've had that said, you know what, I'm going to make a series of books, and it's going to start with this. Usually, you hope to get one done and you know, see how it goes. Not just I'll be doing five. I think that's very brave,
well,
but in this case, it's exciting.
I'd have to say, God willing, I'll get to four or five. But Garrett, I think when I finished the first novel, I looked back and I said, if I had to do this again, would I do it? And I said, no. But but at the same time, I could not, I had to do number two.
Okay.
So now that I'm getting close, to, at least that I've got the rough draft, I'm getting close to novel two, I'd probably say I don't think I would take this on again, and yet I've already written the first chapter to the book three, so I don't know what's...
There you go. How is that for a response from an author here? Well, I'm going to tell you, Jim, I hope that you get through book three, four, and five, because if it's anything like the first book that you've written, The Big House, this is going to be something that people will not only pick up, but they just won't be able to put down. And
well,
as I have to read a lot of books for the different guests that are on the show, and I usually find something to like about the, you know, whatever the author is writing about, but I love everything in your book, so I can't even pick out, like, well, I really like this one thing that you do. I like the entire thing. Can I ask you, we've got, I don't know, about 10 minutes left tonight, and not that this needs to be a writer's workshop or anything, but I would love, just from a historical perspective, from your perspective, having now done this, written the first one, written the second one, and you're starting the third, we have a lot of people that tune into the show that are either aspiring writers, beginner writers that maybe just starting the process of trying to get something published, or people who've written, you know, dozens of books. What advice do you give to people who are undertaking something like what you're doing?
That is a really, really good question, because there were so many answers that came up. And the first thing that came to mind was, have courage.
Mm.
Like the character in this book, face the fear head on about whether you can or cannot do something. So have the courage just to do it. And don't worry about whether you're going to do it perfectly or right. As a family member said to me, your job, because of knowing a bit about my personality, I was told, she said, your job is to do the next chapter imperfectly.
Oh.
And that actually was liberating.
Well, I suppose so, but if I heard those words, I'd be like, no, it has to be perfect.
Yeah.
How do you go about writing the imperfect chapter then?
That I want you to purposely write it with mistakes and imperfectly, because I know you can do that if you
okay.
really try.
Sure.
So it actually was liberating for me when that was said, because we can become a little obsessive compulsive about writing and if it's good enough and all of that. So I would just say to individuals, you know, just have the courage to do it and do it and start reading it, whether it be to a family member or a writer's group that meets and they do it among themselves. But just do it. Just write. And the other part of this question has to do with, and I think it's very important, whether one seeks out a publisher or one becomes what they call an indie, an independent. And that means that one becomes self-publishing and maybe you use a distributor, maybe you don't. You get involved with the cover design, find the people, the editors, and all of that. So there are a couple different approaches, and it just depends on the individual and what they want. The best thing I could suggest is that the individual, if they have not connected with other writers, is to go to a writer's convention and meet other aspiring writers, meet authors, and meet and go to the seminars that are held. I think this is an excellent way of breaking out of the cocoon that many people find themselves enwrapped in.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if that was helpful.
I think that's great. Because we get asked that question all the time, what should I do as a writer? You know, I've written some short stories, or I think I've written the next great American novel, but I don't know what to do, you know. And it's not like it was, you know, 20, 30 years ago where you had, the big five publishers and, you know, that was your only path. Now you can do a variety of different things. So how did you pick your method of publishing?
I went to writers' conventions. I went to writers' conventions, and I had my material read by agents and that were connected to publishing houses and all of that. And then I listened to a panel of speakers, and there was one particular speaker who made a comment, and it had to do with the difference between whether you're going to be an indie, meaning you're going to independently publish, or you're going to go through a publisher, established publisher. And it was what he said about, you know, think about maybe 3 years before it sees the light of day.
Mm-hmm.
Think about the fact that someone else is going to be rewriting possibly a lot of your material, or have you rewrite it in a way that they feel is more marketable. And so I heard, and that also think about the market today. Whether you want to have a paperback or you want to have a ebook.
Right, right.
So now one does have the option, if you decide to become an indie, an independent, you yourself and or with your team that you assemble, you can have the book published on something called CreateSpace, which is, I believe, a subsidiary of Amazon, and they do a beautiful job, far better than, I hate to say this, than many a publisher.
Amazon's in the book business now.
And they're available 24/7.
Right.
And extremely helpful. And then you have Amazon for the ebook. That's where probably 95% of mine sell. Not that they don't sell on the other ebook stores, but that is, if you will, the major game in town right now. And lastly, you have to think in terms of royalties. And you go through an established publisher, and maybe you get 5%, maybe.
Wow.
And you go through Amazon, and you're probably going to get 70%. And so if royalties are something that, you know, an individual is looking, that's only one. If you're looking toward the issue of royalties, that's another consideration as well in mm-hmm. terms of why one might go as an indie as opposed to the established publishing house. So I don't know if I covered some of the salient issues. I think that people who want to get their work out there, some of the considerations they might have or not even know what the questions are that they need to be asking, but maybe a little bit of what I touched upon gives an individual a little bit of the budding writer or the individual who already is writing some ideas about the different approaches that they can take and why one might be better for them than another.
How valuable is that life lesson tonight? Well, Jim, I'm going to tell you, this has been my pleasure to have you on the show. I can't wait to have you back. I want to have you talk about, I'd love to just really dive more into even more of the nuances in The Big House in the future, but I can't wait for book 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10. Whatever you want to write, you come back on. We're going to talk about your books. And
you know
for
what,
everybody, go.
Garrett,
yeah, what?
It's been a pleasure. I've just enjoyed you, and in a sense, I felt like this is the front porch that we're on.
It is.
We're sitting
on the front porch.
We're all on the front porch and just having a good talk.
I agree. Well, everybody go out and buy Jim's book tonight, The Big House. It's available on Amazon. The link is there for you. You can't get any easier than that. You don't even have to search Amazon. The link's there. It takes you right there. Go like Jim's book, The Big House, on Facebook. You can do that. I'm going to say goodnight to Jim. We're going to play a real quick song by Early on Brighton. She was our guest star on the Friday Night Dance Party a few weeks ago. I went to the Xbox grand opening of this video game that's brand new for Xbox on Monday night up in Hollywood, and apparently it's set some kind of record already because they're going to be doing some special edition version of the Xbox. I might not be able to say that, so I forgot I just said that. I didn't tell you that. But this is her song, Unbroken. And then for everybody else, tomorrow we've got Perry Robertson, who is a sound engineer. He's making all of your movies and TV shows like Juno. And the list goes on and on and on. He's got 142 different screen credits on IMDb. He's going to be with us tomorrow talking about sound engineering and why it's important to you when you're listening to movies and TV. And then Friday, of course, we have Carmen Lundy. She's a jazz artist who is going to be on the show 5 p.m. early start time for the Friday Night Dance Party. She's a jazz artist in Hour 1. Hour 2 are your requests, and we will see you all live on Thursday. Jim, it's been a pleasure. I've got the song Unbroken by Early Brighton coming on next, and we'll see you live on Thursday.
Remember when you said together till the end, down forever, yet here I stand alone on this broken road, searching for my shattered heart, the pieces scattered. Every broken promise made makes me strive to push through pain, and I will fight the darkness with all the light I have within. Every page before this time now erased from my mind. I'll divide my weakness into strength, though my memory is haunted, my hope remains undaunted, stronger than the perfect storm. Now
been listening to Rated G Radio.